Full Service Radio is proudly supported and hosted by Simplecast, the easiest way for a podcast creator to publish and distribute audio on the internet. For more information, visit simplecast.com.
Good afternoon. And welcome once again to Junctional Thinking, broadcasting live from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. on Full Service Radio. This is your host, Pierre Vigilance, and I'm very pleased to have you with me again this afternoon. My career path has taken me through a number of different sectors, so from clinical training in emergency medicine through to public health, on into work in the government sector, working in the nonprofit sector, and then into advisory consulting. But throughout that journey, it's become clear to me, as it is to many others, that health and health outcomes cannot and should not be just under the purview of the healthcare system. Healthcare alone cannot solve all of the major complex challenges that go into people being healthy and communities being healthy. And so we have to be functional at the junction, a place where a number of different sectors intersect to make health and wellness happen. And that junction may be with education, with housing, with economic development, with the arts, with media, etc. There are a number of different ways to impact health and health outcomes. And so junctional thinking is this space where we get to explore some of the innovative thinkers and doers in the impact space, some of whom are doing work that actually impacts community health outcomes as well as outcomes just more socially. And today I'm really pleased to be joined by a serial entrepreneur, an investor, an ex-policymaker, ex-operating executive, and overall just very, very in tune, impact-oriented individual, Javier Sade, who is going to talk to us a little bit about his career path, as well as some of the other things that it takes to be functional in the cross-sector space in order to create impact. And this sort of exploring a bit about how we managed to get to this place now where we've got this convergence of profit with purpose and how that actually impacts some of the impact space that we've been getting into for the last few weeks. So, Javier, thank you very much for having us be able to talk to you today.
Hey, happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
You know, this is a bit of a weird show because typically I'm in here with the great Full Service Radio folks. Shout out to Jamal, who's joining us today in the sound room. And usually the guest is in the room with me, but I'm sort of by myself with Javier remote. So thanks for being able to do that. And hopefully it doesn't sound any different to people who are outside. But Javier, could you do us a favor and sort of talk to us a little bit about how you got to where you are right now in the impact investment world or the world of impact, period. I won't even say the investment part, just the world of impact. How'd you get to this point?
Yeah, that's kind of a difficult... Well, first of all, I have to apologize. I'm a little bit under the weather, so if I sound a little weird to those that know me, if they listen, that's the reason. But I think like many people... my professional life and career chapters have formed sort of a squiggly line, yep. Not a straight line. And I started my career in essentially in engineering and operations roles at a Fortune 200 company called Abbott Labs, a pharmaceutical company, making and producing, you know, reagents and drugs and all that kind of stuff. And through some happenstance of chance, I ended up getting recruited out of Abbott Labs by Booz Allen and Hamilton, which is a large consulting firm. And my first projects were in South America, and I got to see all kinds of different industries and, you know, how different people lived. And then I went to graduate school. I went to business school, and after business school, I went to another consulting firm called McKinsey & Company. And there I got exposed to sort of more strategic, kind of corporate level counsel and advice for all kinds of industries, from entertainment companies to some governments, financial institutions. And kind of those three places, Abbott, Booz Allen, and McKinsey, kind of formed the first, what I like to think about as the first third of my career. The next two thirds of my career, which include today, have been a combination of investing in helping start and or starting companies with a super interesting serendipitous detour as a President Obama appointee for a senior policymaker and administration role. So it's been sort of a squiggly line, but as my career developed, I guess you're always in tune with your values, but you get more comfortable in your skin. You try to find ways to do what you really care about and like. And I think the advent of time passing, and I think that happens with everybody, it's not special to me, has given me more and more perspective as to how to use, tools that the corporate sector and the private sector have to do something good for society.
Right, right. I think that, and I know that question, thanks for responding in the way that you did. I asked that question to all guests in just as open a way to allow them to decide if they're going to parachute in and say, well, I always knew, ... or to say exactly what you said, which is to basically debunk this myth that I know a lot of learners have, particularly in the grad school space, that they are going to go straight from point A to point B to point C, and it's going to be a very ordered straight line. And you describing it as squiggly is great, and you also defining it as involving some happenstance and some serendipity, and then multiple different, not only geographic locations, but organizational locations, points to the fact that you were able to pick up and were deliberate about picking up lessons from a number of different places along the way. And I think that that's sort of a big takeaway from a junctional thinking perspective, because we get to learn from a number of different places. Is there anybody or a circumstance or set of circumstances that you sort of would point to and say, you know, this person or this circumstance really stands out to me as a huge beacon, if you will, or a guiding light for how I have gone about moving through my career, because I appreciated the way that they approached me or the way that they approached problems? I know I have one person in particular in mind, but is that a person or a mode of operation from some place in particular that you hold on to, or is it a number of different things?
I think that's a good question, and I actually, about a year ago, I was speaking at some conference somewhere, and they were talking about mentors, and to prepare for what was my piece of the talk, I actually counted my mentors from around junior high all the way to what would have been then today, and I counted 33. Mm-hmm. And then I started doing demographics on the 33. How much were older than me? How much were younger than me? Women, men, people of color, people in different places. And the thing that stood out to me, I think it's interesting that you've invited me to be on this show, is that I realized that a lot of the people I considered mentors early in my career or early in my educational kind of formation years were people that I directly aligned with, along a function or along an industry, or because they were my boss's boss. But as time progressed, I find that my mentors have zero to do with what I necessarily do for a living, which today is either invest or help start companies. And I sit on a couple boards of things I care about, as well as some companies. But as time has gone on, I've realized what the premise of your show is that you have a lot to learn, and you probably learn more from people that are outside of your realm, because they do two things. One is actually teach you things. I think three things. One, they teach you things. Two, they give you different perspectives. Mm-hmm. And three, there's almost like they don't have a dog in the hunt. right? They could be completely focused on, you know, putting solar panels in Africa, but they're learning how to deal with emerging market governments on getting things done in an emerging market has right. been invaluable to me. So I think I can't really point to one particular person. I think it's been an additive, kind of an additive thread of exposure. And I think also my disposition is to, I'm trying to become a better listener, but I think I'm a relatively good listener. I have a lot to learn in that front, on that front as well. But I think internalizing a lot of the advice some of the mentors have given me has been important to me.
Absolutely. I think that mentor piece is, again, something that people talk about having mentors, but then there's a couple things about those people. And let me ask you this. Of those 33 that you did the breakdown of, how many of them are you still in touch with now?
Almost all of them. Mm-hmm. Four have passed away.
Okay.
And I would say almost all of them at different kind of levels of intensity.
Right.
But I would say that the first kind of professional mentor I had, I still talk to this day. But yeah, I would say that for the most part, I sort of keep in touch with all of them.
Yeah, and I think that that's a huge takeaway, because I think that the power of presence is important in mentoring relationships. We have scenarios where, you know, students that we've interacted with a couple of years ago may call us up and say, hey, can you write a letter of recommendation for me? And, you know, I know that I may have colleagues who will listen to this and cringe, but I have to tell them, look, no, I can't, because I don't know what you've been doing. We haven't stayed in touch for me to be able to write a strong letter of recommendation, because let's be clear, a random letter of recommendation does you no good. But a strong one is what you need. And if I can't speak to that because we haven't stayed in touch, intensity aside, right? If we haven't stayed in touch at all, then that becomes a problem. So I think that it's important for people to recognize that no matter how big you let that group get or how big that group becomes, staying in touch with them is hugely important.
Yeah. And I think also it's a two-way street.
Yes.
Like, I think at the point where I am in my life now, I still have a lot of mentors, but I'm also becoming a mentor myself.
Right.
And I feel like, you know, there's different flavors of mentor. There's the kind of the person that gives you advice. There's the mentor that champions you for a promotion.
Right.
There's a, you know, mentor that whose sole job is to smack you on the side of the head and go, you're screwing up.
Yeah.
And I think in either one, mentee, mentor, like any relationship, is a two-way street. So, you know, people seeking advice or people seeking to develop relationships with somebody because they think they can advance their career or their enterprise or whatever, have to realize that there's a demand on time. So I'm not going to say it's a quid pro quo, but it's a two-way street.
Right, definitely. Well, I had a guest on the show a couple of weeks ago, Rachel Duncan from Academy Health, who actually has a background as a musician, and talked a little bit about how if you were to, and I loved this comment from her about if you were to stop at the mistake you make on page one of the music and constantly stopped at that mistake, you would never get through to the second page. And so she realized that the lesson being taught her there was the opportunity to work through the mistakes, come back, yes, but get through to page two, go to page three, get to the end of the piece, and then come back to the beginning and go again. Now, that was her learning from her world of music and composition and playing that she translates into another area of her life. Do you have a sort of non-academic side to you that still informs or teaches you or has taught you how to mm-hmm. operate in your life in general, but particularly in your professional life?
I think this intersection of profit and purpose, or profit and mission, which is being talked about a lot you know, kind of this convergence of philanthropy and profit-making motives, and how, you know, some people are questioning kind of Milton Friedman's maxim that the sole purpose of a corporation is to maximize shareholder value, and the best way to maximize shareholder value is to maximize profit. Maybe actually wrong or misguided. It's not the sole purpose. It's definitely the main purpose, but not the sole purpose. So a lot of people are thinking about this, and there's a lot of examples of companies that have made mission central to their profit making motive, like, you know, Ben and Jerry's or Patagonia, Warby Parker, companies that you immediately associate with being companies that do good, but they also charge a premium for their product, so they actually make more money than if they didn't.
Right.
All that to say that, to me, when I think that the analogy for the music, and the reason I bring this profit and purpose, is because the first company I co-founded was a media and entertainment company, which had it was a profit-making endeavor, radio, internet, and some other media. But the idea behind it was to enable and amplify political discourse in the United States, which at the root has a good thing in the heart of it, which is, you know, a more functioning, more open democracy.
Right.
But it was to make money, right? It was, you know, to sell ads. And I think that experience actually led, it ended up being, I think, there was no term as social entrepreneur, there was, impact investing had not been coined, and it was essentially a social enterprise, and the people that invested in the enterprise were impact investors, and it didn't have a name. But what I learned in that experience, which ended up failing, you know, years later after I had exited, but it failed commercially, was that we tried too much too quick. And if I fast forward to today, sort of how the startup entrepreneurship tech company world works now is through these things called MVPs, minimum viable product.
Oh, okay.
Which is a fast fail and fast iteration way to get products or services to market. And the ability to do that, or having a system and architecture that enables you to do that as an organization, you know, in a clinical trial for a new drug that promises to cure lung cancer, to anything else, you got to have flexibility. And I think that having a relatively big failure early in my career helped me realize that it's good to kind of get close to the edge, sort of near-death experiences, as much as possible, because that's where most of the learning happens.
Interesting. Okay, so close to the edge. You're making me think of a Grandmaster Flash song. Close to the edge is sort of a place where you pretty much have no choice but to learn. And so we're going to put a pin in that. This has been, the voice you've been hearing is that of Javier Sade, serial entrepreneur and sort of impact. I'll call you an impact guru, because I feel like that's sort of becoming more clear to me on how and why it is that you're successful in the spaces that you are. But this is Pierre Vigilance, your host of Junctional Thinking, the podcast here on Full Service Radio, broadcasting live from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. And I wanted to sort of go back to this, connect the flexibility comment you just made back to your admission about listening and how you're a decent listener, but it's something that you know that you've had to improve upon and are continuing to try to improve upon. How do you go about becoming a better listener, especially given what I feel like is a number of different lines of thinking that you probably very quickly go through in your head when you're listening to people talk to you about different ideas?
I think not talking. I mean, is it simple as using silence to force you to absorb. I mean, a lot of people listen to respond, not listen to internalize. This is very, very hard to do, by the way. The people I admire the most are people that are very deliberate in their listening, that say very few words. And when they say words, they're extremely impactful. And the reason, I think one of the main reasons is because they've been able to internalize a lot of information. So to me, it's a conscious, it's sort of a conscious thing. You need to constantly force yourself to do. I mean, I'm guessing there's some natural listeners. I'm not a natural listener. I'm an extrovert. I love to talk. I love to interact with people. And I don't think that should be divorced from listening, but my MO is to actually talk a lot. And I think breakthroughs happen when you don't talk a lot. So right. It's kind of almost counterintuitive. And the other thing that I think goes hand in hand with that is that I think when you're trying to solve a problem or you're trying to pursue an endeavor or anything that has a, you know, some semblance of a goal, you sort of know what you have a view as to what the answer is to that problem. Let's say you have a hypothesis of what that is.
Right.
And how you test the hypothesis is sort of trial and error. That's how Silicon Valley works. That's how, as you know, when you're in your line of work here, that's how discovery of therapeutics work. It's a lot of trial and error. And to me, not being afraid to try and fail, is important for that learning because, you know, I think in life you're going to have a lot more failures than successes. People don't admit to this. But what you want to do, I think, is to that your failures are very tiny, right? You may have 1,000 little failures or what you think in your head are failures, but they're learning moments. And you putting yourself in places where you fail without anybody noticing, okay, or you fail with people noticing, you got to be able to, you know, brush the dirt off your shoulders and keep going. And that, to me, I think is critical to success in any endeavor.
Right. So failing quickly. And I've also heard people say, fail cheap. Don't fail. Don't fail with everything on the table. So have your prototypes, build your prototypes that you're going to test in a way that you're okay with them failing because you know you're going to reiterate, come back, and maybe put a little bit more into the next one, but you're going to take some learning from the first one that didn't cost you everything in the first place. So no, I think that's great advice. Have you always been, I know you mentioned being somebody who likes to talk and is an extrovert, and in this world of what we consider leadership to be, those are traits that naturally would put one in a leadership position or leadership positions. When you've had teams or led teams, how have you been able to bring the people who are a little less extroverted and less talkative up in the rankings, if you will, especially around team members who themselves love to talk and therefore seem to be the natural, in quotation marks, leaders based on their volume rather than what they're actually saying?
empty words. So, look, I mean, our society, and I think this is deeper than managing a business, I think our society values kind of the rock star CEO or the boisterous, you know, leader or whatever. And I think that's a societal DNA thing more than necessarily a leadership sort of requirement. But I think that just being conscious to the different personalities you have in a team. I'll tell you a very specific example. When I took the role in the previous administration, I had never worked in government. I had no idea how actually laws got made. Like I saw Schoolhouse Rock, but I didn't know exactly what the process was. And now all of a sudden, I was in charge of regulating things, making policy, testifying in Congress. I mean, it was scary as hell. But at the same time, I knew that all the people that I had responsibility for were much bigger experts than I. So I realized very quickly that the vulnerability I had or the blind spots I had were actually kind of my strengths, because I would constantly seek advice from my people.
Right.
And I think I'm biased, but I think I didn't screw up that much, because that my perceived weaknesses I use sort of as my strengths, because the people kind of wanted you to succeed, and they felt important because they were teaching the boss, and they were important because I didn't know the first thing about it. I think I learned a hell of a lot, and now I'm much more versed in, you know, kind of, you know, inside the belly of the beast policy work. But I think sort of acknowledging your weaknesses and not hiding them and using people to help you, it's sort of a combination of that.
Right, and that takes some humility and I think some self-awareness, definitely, definitely. Well, we are going to be back in just a few short minutes. You have been listening to Junctional Thinking on Full Service Radio, broadcasting live from the Lion Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Pierre Vigilance, our guest, Javier Sade. We'll be right back in a second. Welcome back. This is Junctional Thinking on Full Service Radio, broadcasting live from the Lion Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Pierre Vigilance, and my guest today is Javier Sade. We've been talking about a few different things, including his career path, some of the serendipity and the sort of multitude of spaces that and industries that he was in the first third of his career, and then how he pivoted into work in government, and now as an impact investor and board member in the space of sort of more purpose-oriented agencies or organizations that are nonetheless profitable. And that's sort of the thing that I wanted to have us start talking about now, is this driving of profit is definitely something that most, if not all, companies are interested in and are sort of, to some degree, have existed for. But purpose has become another part of that equation. And I think that when I talk to public health students in particular, the notion of social entrepreneurship is either new to them or somewhat grimy because it feels too much like business. And there's a lot of folks in public health who like to act like they don't want to be involved in business. But there's a lot of business that goes into people being healthy. And it's not all in the healthcare business. It's in other sectors that impact social outcomes. So why do you think, though, that it's become, I don't want to call it in vogue, but why do you think that there's been this warming to the notion of converging profit and purpose? And do you think that this is just a short-term thing, or is this something that we can look forward to being going to new heights and new levels in the future?
I think the second one. I think impact investing will disappear because it will become part and parcel how capital is allocated. I mean, before, if somebody was going to deliver 4 more cents per share per quarter to the bottom line, you would kind of maybe look the other way on polluting a river, especially in countries that have lax environmental laws.
Right.
But now, I think there's a couple of big kind of picture things at play. One, and this is a global phenomenon, one is that income inequality and wealth concentration has reached crazy proportions. I think it's something like the 100 richest families in the world have more money than half of the world, right? And then that the bottom half of the world, just 50 families, right? Of which probably 25 of them are in America. And so I think that's at play. The fact that prosperity has not been evenly shared, that the fact that governments seem to sometimes align with business much more seamlessly because they're the ones that donate to campaigns, which is kind of my second point, is sort of how the how we think of ourselves as a democracy, but in reality, the campaign finance laws create real problems that sort of grease the skids for big enterprises and kind of screw the little guy. The third thing that has happened is more demographics.
Okay.
Baby boomers were a lot of them. They didn't have that many kids, which is where I am, Generation X. And then the next generation, millennials / Gen Z, are bigger than the boomers. And those and that generation is demanding different things from life. Some people complain that they're too idealistic or that they have unrealistic expectations about how work and life balance happens. But I think that as the wealth between the boomers, and this is trillions and trillions of dollars between the boomers and their kids and grandkids, the biggest wealth transfer in history, that money is going to be invested differently. And I think the fourth thing that has happened, I believe, is that people are willing to pay a little bit of a premium to, just go into Whole Foods, right? People are willing to pay a premium for something that's healthier for you and grown sustainably than mass-produced. People are willing to pay a premium for a car that doesn't emit that much, and so on and so forth. So I think there's been a much bigger convergence of events at play, and business is now a real player in there because of the influence they wield in societies.
So let me ask you this, because I know that sometimes, and let's talk about the food piece, right? We talk about, so you mentioned Whole Foods and the idea of, going there because you believe or understand that the food purchased there is going to be of better quality and better for you. But the question I have for you is, what about for the individual who, for example, I watch some kids going to school in the morning and their breakfast is potato chips and soda, right?
Yep.
Now, even if they had a Whole Foods in their community, the 50 cents for the chips and the 50 cents for the soda, and maybe not the dollar, let's say it's a dollar each, that $2 would probably buy them one item at Whole Foods, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
The inequality element and the disparity piece that you spoke to earlier on, and the fact that that does exist, and we know it exists, especially in distressed communities, is matched with a lack of access to certain things, and more than anything, a lack of capital, a lack of cash in hand to be able to interact with that higher end, mm-hmm. better for you product. So how do we, there seem to be a number of different things that need to be done, and I know this would be a very complicated question to ask, like how do we narrow that gap? But but to some extent, what are some of the steps and or whichever angle you want to take, what are some of the tools that community-based players need to be using in order to make it so that some of that gap can be reduced? Maybe it's not bringing a Whole Foods in, but maybe it's bringing something else, and maybe it's bringing some price point appropriate things into the market such that a kid isn't eating chips and soda on the way to school for breakfast.
Yeah, it is a very complicated question, I'm kind of very sad to have brought it up, because I'm going to dig myself into a hole. Well, look, you're alluding to one aspect of that is food deserts, right? Like something people have been trying to work on, and you as commissioner of two big cities probably worked on as well.
Right.
Yes, Whole Foods is expensive, and that disparity in what you need to afford a good drink and good snack at Whole Foods buys you a whole week's worth of snacks at some other place.
Right.
So how do you kind of bridge that gap? Well, my sense is that the large food companies, or large anything, tries to find the path of least resistance to produce services or goods.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we can go into industrial farming and, you know the millions of acres of cornfields in the U.S. and in Russia, in Europe, that feed us, and the reason that exists and everything's based on corn syrup is because it's cheap. So I think that innovation has a lot to do with moving us forward. And when people think about innovation, people typically think about, you know, IT or, you know, software or anything having to do with digital. But the fact is that there's all kinds of innovative things happening in agriculture, which eventually are going to make potentially food production in a sustainable way as cheap as the mass-produced kind of factory farming stuff.
Yes.
That takes time. But I think what you're seeing now, not only in the food desert thing, but, you know, if you will stay within the health realm, you know, orphan drugs.
Okay.
The reason pharmaceutical companies don't pursue some drugs is because, well, there's only 20,000 people with the disease. It's going to cost me $1 billion to get it to market, so I'm not going to do it.
Right.
But now with all this amazing bioinformatics and, you know, fast iteration IT, and, you know, soon quantum computing, you're going to be able to actually discover and test drugs very quickly, lowering their costs. So I think using innovation for good, I think that's my punchline, is I'm seeing it in a lot of places. And, you know, I'm currently a venture partner in a fund that invests in financial technology, so anything having to do with innovation and financial services. And it just so happens that a lot of the companies that not only we've invested in, but that are kind of becoming really, really big players in upending how capital and financing happens, is actually serving less served people, right? Like, if you think about, you know, in the U.S. alone, I mean, around the world, it's maybe 1 billion people that are underbanked and unbanked, but in the U.S., it's something like 50 million people that don't even have a bank account. All that stuff. And the reason is, well, they don't have credit scores, or they're afraid to be deported. And a lot of these innovations in financial services actually reduce frictions, create inclusion, and you're bringing people into the financial system. And you would argue that without being in the financial system, you're never going to succeed, right?
Right.
So to me, there's like a, it, I mean, some people do it deliberately, but the biggest opportunity, I think, in financial services, for example, is not to lend more money to wealthy people to buy yachts. The real opportunities are in micro-lending in India.
Yeah, Grameen.
And,
right.
Exactly, things like that. So to me, innovation for good is a real big part of the formula, I think.
Right. No, I think that, and I appreciate how, and I hope that people picked up on this. So, you know, there are many big problems out there that are hugely complex, tangled balls of yarn, wire, and a whole bunch of other stuff. But if we can choose to decide to sort of look at it as that and say, well, that's just too confusing to get into, so I'm going to leave it as a mess on the floor. Or we can say, okay, there's a thread in there, though, that we might be able to do something with. And you chose the thread of of taking the thoughts about innovation away from, say, tech in the form of, say, software development and app development, where a lot of people go, and saying, well, but how might we use technology to change how we grow things and where we grow things, and then potentially change who has access to those things quickly and more cheaply, so that we can address the scenario that I gave you at the beginning of this sort of blip that we were talking about. And I think that nimbleness, if you will, is something that I think is obviously something that has made you successful, but it's also something that people need to be listening for and trying to grow within themselves, so as not to get stuck in just how complex the problem is. There's a way to break some of these things down, but we have to be willing to take some educated risks in going down particular paths with particular types of product for particular populations, which is sort of what you ended up talking about with respect to the food piece. But if we were to go back to the bigger specter of, you mentioned governments and who they typically partner with. When you think about community-based work, and at any level, be that a health system, be that a philanthropic organization or whatever it is, there are probably some tools that executives and others working in those spaces need to have in order to be able to be really functional from an impact perspective. Right, so I know you and I were having a conversation about awareness of qualified opportunity zones the other day, and how being aware of them puts you in a position to maybe leverage the investments being made in those distressed communities for the good of whatever social enterprise it is that you're involved in. But that's just an awareness of a tool or a product, if you will, not a tool. Are there some specific, like if you had to say, well, here are the top 2 to 3 things that people, period, who are in impact-oriented spaces should be aware of as they think about trying to create impact, what kind of tools or ways of thinking would you suggest that they have?
You mean the people that are in public policy roles?
They could be. Well, actually, that's a good question. So they could be in public policy roles, so they could be, but that could be someone in the planning department, say for example, in a city. But they could also be the executive director of a community-based organization that serves pregnant women. But they could just as well be a member of an after-school community that serves kids and does soccer and spoken word and school engagement, like DC Scores does. So. But really more so for the leadership in the organizations, wherever they are, public or private, but they want to be of impact. And they say that they're about impact. What should be in their toolkit? What are the couple things should be in their toolkit?
Yeah, okay, I understand the question. Thank you for the clarification. So I think my sense is that because it's sort of a relatively new convergence, this profit with purpose or impact investing or mission capitalism, it has a lot of different names. Standards have not yet been set, right? So if you think how you measure profitability in a company, there are accounting standards, investors, ROI, return on investment, math is math. And with some standards, you can compare apples to oranges. So if you can make one more dollar in selling aspirin versus selling lettuce, I'm going to go with the aspirin. One more dollar is one more dollar. In the world of impact, I think what's happening is that a lot of people are searching for sort of heuristics that lead to actual standards you can measure. Because to somebody, real impact may be less incidence of lung cancer in Jackson, Mississippi. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But to somebody else, impact may mean less CO2 emitted by the 5 boroughs of New York City. Right. Or, fill in the blank. So the issue I think we're having now is how do we all adopt standards? And probably the easiest way to think about this is what we use. Even though I do a lot of stuff in fintech, some of the best fintech is actually dollar bills. And the reason dollar bills work so well is because everybody has them and everybody takes them. So they're just a mode to transfer and store value. In the world of impact, you still have this kind of not amorphous, but kind of it's still forming. And one of the things that's kind of rising to the top is, I would say, the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals. I think there's like 17 of them.
Yes.
And you're seeing a lot of capital allocators and corporations and governments actually adopting the standards. And once the standards are adopted, I believe that's when you have ramp up at scale of all these strategies. So the first thing is, as a public policy person, as a company person, whatever, I think getting smart on where the world is going in terms of measuring impact is important. Mm-hmm. The second, I believe, is looking at I'm going to give you an example of the government, an example in private enterprise. In the government, there's all this amazing technology, and most of the technology that Silicon Valley says invents actually was born in from very early stage federal funded research. So the government is extremely good, right? NIH in your space at discovering, you know, molecules that do something great for, you know, lymphoma, but taking it to market takes a different thing. So if the governments are really good at kind of that early stage discovery, they should be able to use technology to better interact with citizens, right? Providing data, open architectures. It's our data, right? It's the citizens' data. We pay. Government employees are our employees. So the ability to access data, which is the biggest currency right now, will enable you to create better services. If you're a private enterprise, thinking about innovation in a broader way is important, right? Like, every company is about technology. When you think about the industrial Midwest, Goodyear, I don't know, that may be a Japanese company now, maybe it's a bad example, but Goodyear rubber was born out of petroleum. That's a technology, right? So there's technology in every single thing we touch, and really being open-minded about all these technologies that are not necessarily in your space, but are happening, I think will enable some of this junction thinking that you're hoping to unearth with these podcasts.
I think that that's a really, really good way to sort of close this out, because I think we really do try to get people to think differently and outside of their spaces and places of natural comfort about the challenges that they're dealing with a view to moving towards solutions, but using multiple different injects or inputs to do so. So to your point, rubber and petroleum are linked, but one would not necessarily have thought that one was connected to the other in the same way that one might not think about blockchain and access to care. But they are. But those two things are and will be linked to one another in the future, in the very near future, in fact. And I appreciate your commentary about data, too. I know there's a lot of people out there who want us to help free that so that we can make more use of it. But Javier, thank you so much for being on the show today, and I hope that you feel better soon. But even being under the weather, you provided a ton of really great insight into not only the way that you think, but also the way that your sector's impact investing space thinks. So I appreciate you for joining us today.
That was awesome. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Javier. And to listeners, thank you very much for tuning in. Again, this is Pierre Vigilance, your host of Junctional Thinking, broadcasting live from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. We look forward to seeing you, to having you tune in to the next episode. We'll talk to you soon. Thanks again for your time. Take care.